Good evening, everybody. Is this one on? Yes, can you hear me? I'm Jean Strauss, the director of the Common Center for Scholars and Writers. We're in part of the Common Center library space. On behalf of the Common Center and our co-sponsors of this evening, live from the New York Public Library, it's a great pleasure to have you all here to hear Jennifer Egan and Laura Miller talk about Jennifer's latest novel, just out in paperback, A Visit from the Goon Squad. I have to say, as I was typing up these remarks this afternoon, I kept writing A Visit from the Good Squad, which isn't really the idea. Live from the New York Public Library asks all of its speakers to provide a 7-word bio of themselves for this introduction. And Jennifer Egan's 7-word bio is, "Woman seeks fantastical escape from daily life." Jennifer Egan was a fellow at the Coleman Center, excuse me, in 2004-2005. Several of her fellows, or a few of them anyway, are here tonight. It's very nice to see all of you. She was then just starting a new novel, and she didn't have much to say at the lunch talk presentation that we have for each of the fellows while they're in residence here. And so instead of talking about where she was in this new novel, she talked about her process and how she goes about writing a novel. I'm going to embarrass her a little bit, maybe, but it was wonderful because she talked about how when she's sort of just feeling her way into a new set of characters, a new scenario, a new idea, she said, "I just wander around." And she said, "I don't mean I wander around in books and magazines and my apartment. I really wander around." And she then told a story about having a feeling about going back to where her grandmother had lived in Rockford, Illinois, when she was starting a new book, and flying to O'Hare Airport and renting a car at the airport and driving north, and suddenly getting caught in a huge downpour rainstorm, so blinding and intense that she couldn't even see the car in front of her. And she said, in telling this story, that she should have been completely terrified, and instead she was just exhilarated because she felt, this is where my next novel is going to start. And in fact, that's what the beginning of her next novel, Look at Me, is a woman driving like that in a terrible rainstorm, heading north from Chicago and getting in a terrible car accident, and the story unfolds from there. So it was a wonderful glimpse into how this works for Jenny anyway, and I think probably for other people, different kinds of wandering around. A brilliant writer of fiction and journalism, Jenny has published short stories in publications including The New Yorker, Harper's, McSweeney's, and Granta. Her first novel, The Invisible Circus, came out in 1995 and was released as a movie starring Cameron Diaz in 2001. Do we need some more chairs? Someone can take care of that because we should find some seats for you. Thanks. That same year, 2001, when the Cameron Diaz movie of The Invisible Circus came out, Jenny's second novel, Look at Me, appeared and was a finalist for the National Book Award. Her third novel, The Keep, was a bestseller in 2006. And all along, she's been writing first-rate, prize-winning journalism. Pieces primarily for the New York Times Magazine, most recently one you may have read a couple of months ago, about Laurie Berenson, the American released from a Peruvian prison after 15 years for abetting terrorism. One of the astonishing things about Jennifer Egan as a writer is her audacity. She sets major new challenges for herself in each new book. Not every novelist does that. Many people tend to write the same kind of book again and again. She totally does not do that. And perhaps most dramatically, she's made a change like this in A Visit to the Visit from the Goon Squad. This extraordinary novel, cutting back and forth between characters, worlds, and time zones, is at once disciplined and wild, local and large, edgy, funny, inventive, exciting, and deeply smart. Deeply and modestly smart. It has already won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction for 2011 and is up for several additional prizes. I will leave the in-depth conversation about the novel to Jenny and Laura. I want briefly to thank several people who are helping us here tonight, Meg Stemler and the rest of the staff from Live, and Paul Holdengraber from Live, and the Coleman Center staff, Marie Dorigny, Katie Pyatt, and Kelly Cook, and also 192 Books, which will be selling books, has already probably been selling some of your books, and will continue after the talks. Asked for her own seven-word bio, Laura Miller said, quote, "Shorter is harder. I'm blowing this deadline." I don't think you've heard each other's seven words before now. That line actually scans very well, I realized, as I was hearing it to myself. Shorter is harder. I'm blowing this deadline. A line of poetry. We could actually combine these two bios. Woman seeks fantastical escape from blowing deadlines. In long form, Laura Miller does not blow deadlines. I don't know her well enough to know that for sure, but from her work, I imagine it's true. A senior writer at Salon.com, which she co-founded in 1995, she is a superb writer and literary critic, and she edited the Salon.com Reader's Guide to Contemporary Authors. She's a frequent contributor to the New York Times Book Review, and wrote its last word column for 2 years. Her work also appears in a number of other publications, including The New Yorker, The Wall Street Journal, and Los Angeles Times. Jenny and Laura will talk for about 45 minutes and then take questions. You can buy copies of A Visit from the Goon Squad on your way out. Jenny's agreed to sign them. So please join me in welcoming Jennifer Egan and Laura Miller.
Is this working? Yes, it is. Okay, tell me if my earring is banging into it. It is a total delight to be back here. I remember this place very fondly. I'd actually forgotten the content of that talk. And I was a little bit filled with guilt to remember that I actually still haven't started the book that I was here to research. But we'll let that go. It's always a great pleasure to talk to you, Laura. So
this is the third interview that Jen and I have done together, so hopefully we will find something new to talk about. Fortunately, I was telling her earlier, her books are always completely different, and so there's usually plenty of new topics. I want to ask you first about the structure of A Visit from the Goon Squad, because I think the last time I interviewed you, we walked away. This was in Central Park, and we were walking through the park afterwards, and I asked you what you were working on, and you told me you were working on stories. Hmm. And I'm thinking it's probably the same book, but at some point you went from working on stories to having a novel. And there's been a lot of discussion about, is this a novel, or is this a story collection, or is this linked stories, or whatever. I'm just kind of curious as to, first of all, how you see it, and then how it evolved. I mean, did it start out as literally like writing a bunch of stories and then seeing that they all needed to go together? Or how did that come about?
It was very organic. It's interesting because I think that must have been the summer of 07, because it was the Keep, yeah, that we were there to talk about, yeah, and I think it was in paperback. So, or maybe it was 06. Anyway, I feel like this is too loud, but if no one else is bothered, I'm going to just let it go. Anyway, so yes, I was actually, I'm sorry to say, avoiding writing the book I had come here to the Coleman Center to research, or somehow not being quite willing to start it yet. I had done a fair amount of research, and I felt somehow that the research felt impenetrable to me at that moment. So I decided to work on stories basically to just, keep myself entertained and kind of do something productive while I was waiting to begin this other book. And the first one that I wrote was inspired by a real event, which was I actually was in a hotel, over the holidays, washing my hands in the sink, looked down and saw a wallet lying in a bag, and felt kind of excited by that, rather in the same way that I was by the highway trip during the storm. I think because I suddenly made, well, I immediately thought, your wallet's going to get stolen. This is New York. You can't do that. And that immediately led to a lot of associations I had with being robbed, which I have been so many times. It's embarrassing, although it's gotten better in recent years. I don't know if I somehow seem a little more authoritative, but I really must have had the biggest sucker sign on my face. Luckily, not including physical violence, but really practically everything else. And the one that sticks with me the most was that my wallet was stolen once, and then I got a call from a Citibank employee who was very helpful and understanding. I think I cried. I was so upset about my wallet. And she said, you know, we were notified, you know, this is a service Citibank provides, that we can help you to sort of get organized after this theft. And so what we're going to do now is choose your new PIN number. And so we went through a process, and I chose a number, and she said, no, but you can't choose the number you had before. And I said, oh, no, my old number was this. Okay, so you get the picture here. So we hung up. I was greatly relieved. I'd been told my card would be arriving very soon. And then I can't remember exactly how it came to light that she had gone to a cash machine and overdrawn my checking account. And obviously that was dreadful. But one thing that made it so dreadful was the fact that I'd been on the phone with her for like 15 minutes and actually cried on the phone with her. And she'd been so nice. I kept thinking, but she sounded so nice. So I think that sort of stayed in my mind, this kind of encounter between two women, one of whom was robbing the other. And this had to have been, you know, 12, 13 years ago. But anyway, I saw that wallet. And just in 1 second, I suddenly thought, who would take it? Who would be stand here right now and just take it? And why? So I didn't explore that further because I was with my family at dinner. But I thought, okay, I'm gonna just for fun sit down and just write from that moment. So I did, and I wrote what became the first chapter, which I thought was a short story that I was kind of doing temporarily. And then in the course of writing that, there was a mention, and I should just say that I write so blindly that I kind of don't see what's coming with my first drafts. It just sort of emerges. So this other character is mentioned in passing, a music producer who sprays pesticide in his armpits and puts gold flakes in his coffee. And I found myself thinking about that after I'd finished the story. I thought, yeah, but why? Why does he do that stuff? Like, it's sort of funny to someone outside, but obviously he's not doing it to be funny. Why is it something that he would do? Excuse me. So I thought, okay, I'll write one more about him. And that was really fun because I moved backward in time and Sasha, the wallet thief, was still working for him in the second chapter or story, as I thought they were. And all of that seemed great. Like, I love the fact that we knew more about her than he did. And, for example, at one point he can't find his little box of gold flakes. And she says, oh, you dropped it. Here it is. And, of course, we're like, oh, my God, she stole it. So all of that seemed really fun. And then my attention was caught by a character in who's mentioned in his story, his ex-wife. He says, you know, they moved to Westchester. He knew it wasn't going to work. But she has thrived there and is now in the number one doubles team. So I thought, yeah, but okay. So she plays doubles. But who is she? So I wrote a chapter about her. And then in the course of that, I think that was the time at which I realized it was a book. So I guess that was after we, or maybe, well, no, I think that must have been after I saw you. Suddenly I had these four older stories that I had written and published, but had felt that they were part of something larger, but I wasn't really sure what. And when I was working on the chapter about the ex-wife in Westchester, one of those old stories kind of stuck out a tentacle and attached to it. And it was a celebrity profile in which the writer, a male, who's angry and having all kinds of difficulties, basically attacks his subject, a young female movie star, and ends up in jail. And I suddenly thought, what if he were the brother of my music producer's ex-wife? What if he comes out of jail and he moves to Westchester with them? And I just thought that seemed like such a fun idea. And so I included him in the story, and that seemed to work. And at that point, it felt like it was all commingling. But I really never used the word novel to describe it, and I'm still a little hesitant to do that. I don't tend to call it a novel, and it actually wasn't. It didn't have any attribution on the cover or any category, I guess. So I'm not sure about that. I guess I just thought it's a book. You know, yeah. People will sort of call it what they want. Although I feel like story collection describes it less satisfactorily for me than novel. But I think some people would say that that's what it was.
Yeah. So at the point that you decided that the next character you were going to write about was this music producer, was that the point at which it started to seem like it was really going to be about music or the music industry, or did that emerge?
I think at that point, yes, yeah. Because even just to write that chapter, I had to actually do a fair amount of research, because it turns out that, you know, Benny is very neurotic in various ways and having a hard time, and one of the he's in the middle of a divorce and having trouble connecting to his son, but he's also in a state of rage over the state of the music industry, and actually not just the fact that everyone's losing money, but more the sound. He's very upset by digital sound. He thinks it's terrible. But in fact, I did not really understand the difference between digital and analog. So I had to do some pretty serious investigations to try to understand that. So,
Wait, let me interrupt you. So mm-hmm. Was this cause of his something that you got the idea for and then you needed to research it? Or did you start researching music producers and then say, oh, this is something that my character needs to be upset about?
No, I knew he was upset, and then I thought, okay, but what is this thing he's upset about?
Yeah.
And actually, I should say that I know where I got that idea too. Years and years ago, Neil Young wrote this diatribe against digitization, which was reprinted in Harper's. I'm not sure where it appeared in the first place, and I was really struck by it. I mean, this would have been, you know, he was complaining about CDs. I mean, this had nothing to do with, buying music online. He basically felt that that the sound was horrible, that it was destroying music. And I remember he concluded by saying something like, you know, we'll get through this, but let's just see how much damage it does. And the idea that a musician would feel that way about a technology that I had always thought was supposed to be so fantastic, like yeah. The sound is so clear, it's so clean, and he was basically saying that's exactly what's horrible about it. That's not how music sounds. So I guess that idea had also lodged in my head. And so when I got to Benny, who was just this sort of bundle of worry and anger, and you know, it just seemed clear that he was mad about the same thing that Neil Young was mad about. But now it was time to find out what exactly that was. Because I knew that I was interested in, I wanted to show Benny at work. I mean, it wasn't even that I thought he should be at work. He was, as I was writing, that's what he was doing. And so, you know, you can't write about someone recording music without having any idea of what that consists of. So I spent a lot of time on the phone with a mixer producer who was incredibly generous with his time. And I think I even started, I don't know whether I was really reading books yet, because I actually worked pretty quickly on that chapter. But I certainly, just to write that chapter, I had to be on the phone maybe 6 hours with this guy. Wow. And I guess at that point, and I had been following Lynn Hirschberg's writing about the music industry with great pleasure for years for the Times Magazine. And I should also say that I had this yen to write about music myself as a journalist, which was somewhat stymied by the presence of Lynn Hirschberg at the Times Magazine, because she was doing such a great job and had so many great contacts that I would say, hey, I want to write about music. And they'd say, okay, what do you want to do? And I'd think, I don't know. So nothing much had come of that, although I did actually get one assignment, and I'm wondering if it was actually for someone who's here. Oh my God, that's amazing. He is here. It was for him. Carrie Lauerman, at the time, who was at the Times Magazine then and now at Salon, made my dream come true by giving me an assignment in the music industry. And it was to write about a pair of identical twin rappers called Dime, D-Y-M-E. And they were supposed to be having an album that was coming out. And so the idea was, it was a small piece, but I think it was for a special issue about sort of debuts or people starting out doing things. So my job was to write about the, this album's emergence and what it was like for them.
And did he know when he gave you this assignment that you're obsessed with twins?
No.
We can ask him.
And I hadn't even thought about that myself until that this moment, that it was a funny thing that
there's
they were
so
twins.
There's so many twins in your
books. It's weird.
Yeah.
Well, it all sounds like just an assignment that was destined to succeed, but in fact it actually did not, because it became clear to me as I spent time with these women and their various, record company representatives that their album actually was not going to come out. Like, nothing was happening. There was a lot of talking and a lot of meeting, but there was no product was imminent. And when I told Kerry that, he said, "We're done." So that was that. However, in the course of following them a bit, I did get what I think was sort of the basic DNA for my sister group in Goon Squad, Stop Go, because they did in fact live in Mount Vernon, and most importantly, they did have an orange shag lined recording studio that their father had built for them. But I can't even find their, I don't remember what their names were, but Dime is nowhere in Google. And I think it, I mean, the truth is, I think what I was seeing, but I didn't even know it yet, was that all that was happening to lots of people. I mean, the music industry was really starting to tank. So contracts that had been embarked on were not being fulfilled. And that's sort of, in retrospect, kind of what I was witnessing. So anyway, all of that, I think once I was writing about Benny and thinking back on Neil Young and recalling Dime, you know, the deed was done. It was going to be about music. Yeah. Suddenly it just seemed clear to me.
Well, it sounds like your journalism work and your fiction are really kind of flow into each other quite a bit.
I think they really do, sort of more than I realize. But yes, they do. And sometimes even in deeper ways than this, where the actual whole kind of thematic inquiries come about because of journalism pieces I've done. The one I'm thinking of is I did a piece in late 2000 about gay teens who are closeted in their home lives but out online. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to sort of understand how this worked, you know, what was this like? And it was actually kind of hard. I mean, I thought, okay, so I'm going to meet with these teens and hang out with them at their homes. This is what I normally do. Find out what it's like. I guess I'll watch them on the computer. That's how I'll understand what they're doing online. You know, these gay teens who are closeted, like, how are they going to explain the presence of me in their homes? So then I was really, and this was pre-social networking, so there were, you know, none of those sites existed, and you found people more through bulletin boards.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I was posting wildly, I'm from the New York Times, I want to talk to you, and as soon as I would say, you know, I want to meet, they'd run a mile. Who could blame them? So anyway, I had to learn a whole different way of doing journalism in the course of that. But the thing that really stuck with me was these were kids who felt that their physical lives, their home lives, were fake, and they actually referred to them that way. Because from their point of view, the central fact about them was obscured, so all of that was not real. They had fake girlfriends, you know, all kinds of stuff, or boyfriends. And but their online lives, they considered to be their real lives, where they had relationships and friends. But their real lives were, of course, fraught with all kinds of deception. Of, you know, the obvious things, adults posing as kids, but also weirder stuff. Like, I remember there was one guy who was part of a whole group of friends that he was really excited to be part of, and they would all trade all these emails, and they were, IMing each other all the time. And after a couple of months of this, he started to notice that they had certain habits of speech that were common to all of them. Yeah. And he got a little bit suspicious, and when he started pushing, some of them seemed to kind of disappear. The long and short of it is he realized that they were all one person, and the one person was not a teen. It was some guy who was having fun messing with this kid's head. So all of those odd juxtapositions of sort of the question of what is reality in this new world that we live in, I think led pretty directly to my writing The Keep, which is a gothic thriller that sort of asks the same question, really, using a gothic environment, which is where the question always is this real or not? Mm-hmm. You know, is it psychological? Are there ghosts? Is there a scientific explanation? It just somehow all came together in that way. But I don't think I would have done it if it hadn't been for that article about the teens.
Even though those two stories, these teens are in the South. You're talking about these teenagers in the South being online, and then this other thing is like these straight people in a castle in Czechoslovakia.
Well, it's true there are some differences.
And they can't get online.
But, you know, it's true. Yes. Well, I initially thought when I was working on that it's going to be about how in the gothic realm you can't get online. I actually thought that would be kind of an exciting thing. Yeah. You know, this guy is really hooked on being online, but when he goes to the castle, he can't be. What will happen? Oh my God. But what I didn't realize at all until I was working on it was that, in fact, it was luckily more interesting than that, because I'm not sure how far I would have really gotten with that. Like, once the satellite dish sinks into the mossy pool, what do you do? But in a way, what I started to realize was that actually it was about the question of whether we live in a Gothic environment now. Because the nature of the Gothic is that you're expecting apparitions all the time. You're constantly expecting communications from without. And I think that pretty accurately describes the way most of us live pretty much minute to minute at this point.
And that you create a reality out of your imagination that then you can't distinguish between the real and the imaginary.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the emotional dysfunction or whatever.
Right,
it is
exactly. Is it you or is it coming from outside?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's an example of the connection. But this one was important too in a different way. You know, this desire to write about music, a tiny bit of knowledge of one tiny little bit of sort of a story about musical people, and then just kind of using a journalistic approach to doing research, like basically just I did actually read some interesting books about the music world, but I found those conversations so dynamic and helpful with this guy, and I think actually again that was basically just approaching it as a journalist would and trying to get the answers much faster than I would if I sat down with a lot of technical books and tried to figure it out.
Well, it's interesting that a lot of these ideas that we're talking about are about ultimately come to the issue of technology, which you write about more than a lot of novelists, even though you claim not to be that knowledgeable about it.
I'm not really that knowledgeable about it. Let's put it this way. I have a Samsung phone, okay? No, I'm really not. But I am very interested. I mean, I guess I just feel like it feels like, in a way, one of the big stories that's unfolded in the time that I've been alive. You know, I'm 48. And when I think back to my childhood and sort of the role that technology played in it, I had a little radio. And, you know, I was on the phone a fair amount as a teenager, but my phone experiences consisted, like all of ours, of calling someone, and either the telephone rang and rang and rang and no one answered, or someone answered, or you got a busy signal. Yeah. Like, that, those were the only options. That was how we communicated.
And you had to stand in line at the bank to cash a check.
Exactly. So, I guess, to go from that to what we have now, where one of the things that really interests me is that, like, when I taught at NYU about a year ago, and I remember thinking, this is great, because I really need to stay in touch with, what kids and their relationship to technology, or young people. But the thing that was so funny was, again and again, talking to my students, they would speak sort of longingly and a little wistfully of how they feel kind of old compared to kids who grew up with Facebook. And I started thinking, I think that the technology is moving so fast now that no one feels like they really have a handle on it. I mean, if 21-year-olds are sort of feeling outmoded by 15-year-olds, whoa.
Yeah.
So I don't set out thinking about, to write about that, but it finds its way in every time, because I feel like, I am interested in American life and the forces acting upon it. I'm also interested in just sort of identity and how it works. And I think, too, that, technology interacts with that in all kinds of ways. So it feels impossible to escape from it. I don't know whether my own reluctance to plunge forward technologically at the same pace as other people. I mean, I'm not that behind, but I'm not forward, that's mm-hmm. for sure. I don't know whether there is something about that is wanting to let me, that I feel maybe, or maybe I'm just rationalizing, it frees me to go forward a little more imaginatively if I hang back a little in real life. I don't know.
You mean if you're not trying to keep up with the latest thing, or if you're not?
I guess I mean that if I get caught up in always being, having what's there, I guess maybe I wonder whether it would make me less imaginative about what there could be.
Right.
I don't know. It may just be that I'm kind of a Luddite.
Well,
that's the other possibility.
You do have this chapter where you imagine the you know, this future New York, and there are these things in it that are, you know, there's just all this music marketing going on and texting and toddlers who are pre-verbal, being able to give marketing research feedback and that kind of thing. And you know, I remember reading it and thinking, oh, you know, sometimes it's sort of exaggerated, but there are things that are in this that are actually happening now, and they are in there with the things that are sort of seem sort of outlandish, and yet, you know, any of those things could actually happen. I mean, conceivably, these starfish handsets could come along, and toddlers could be deciding what the hit songs are.
You know, I think that, I mean, that I wrote that chapter pre-iPhone, and I have to say, I sort of feel like, in a way, it's already happening. I mean, you know, that technology is so almost candy-like in its you know, in its appeal. Yeah. I mean, Apple always does that. When I've seen toddlers sort of using their parents' iPhones, and it's pretty much exactly what I was imagining. So, yeah, satire is tough to write here in America. I keep trying. But I wasn't imagining that far forward. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking in sort of the 2020s. And I was more just trying to be playful. But I do think, in a way, there is. I like to imagine forward technologically, and it may be that hanging back helps me do that somehow.
Yeah, it gives you just a little bit more space to work in.
And I should say one more thing. The whole idea of I posit this idea that music is being marketed through social networking, but a few steps beyond where we are. Like, I sort of imagine it's not exactly Facebook or anything else. It's just sort of a ubiquitous structure that we're all part of, which is sort of, I guess, what Facebook is becoming. But of course, there's been this outcry, or there is a kind of scandal alluded to, in which it was discovered that lots and lots of people were pushing this, that, or the other, not because they really liked it, but because they were paid to, especially political bloggers. And which I think is so conceivable. I mean,
no, that does happen. There are marketing plans that involve sending people to bars or having them order drinks and stuff. So products are sold that way by these kind of people who are like secret agents, you know, who are actually working for the marketers. So yeah, that happens.
But in fact, harkening back to Lynn Hirschberg, my great source, she wrote an article about Rick Rubin, the head of, I can't remember what music studio he's head of, I'm not even sure that he still is, but he's this sort of unusual guy. He doesn't really look like a music executive. He meditates, and he's this very sort of unusual guy who came in to take over. I'm not sure which, but anyway, in the article, he talks about how he imagines the future of music marketing sort of happening by a team of people who will just kind of get out there and spread the word. And my immediate thought was, yeah, but do they tell people you're paying them? Yeah. So that was really where that idea came from.
Yeah. Do you have a particular investment in the music industry? I mean, you wanted to write about music, but you haven't necessarily written about it before. I mean, was this something that had been stewing for a while? Or?
No, I don't think I have. I mean, I think some people read this and assume that I'm sort of a music head. And in fact, I ended up on a panel where I think my fellow panelists were surprised at how little I had to say, really, compared to what they had to say about the music world. I mean, I was interested in it and curious about it, but much in the same way that I was interested and curious about Gothic literature while I was working on The Keep. I feel like in some sense, these are kind of temporary obsessions because, in one sense, I guess I sort of feel that I've exhausted them by the end. I love music and I have strong memories and feelings about it, but I don't listen to it actually all that much. I don't listen to it as I work, although I did working on this book. I feel sort of like I engaged with that industry to the degree that I wanted to and hoped to in this book, and my sense is I'll be kind of moving on now.
Well, that's very much the way a journalist thinks. You completely immerse yourself in a topic. You know everything about it that you can to write the piece, and then as soon as it's done, you move on, and probably people come to you and ask you about, you know, terrorism or models or whatever.
Right, and I'm like, can I reread my piece before we have this conversation? Yeah, but I think, I don't, you know, it's true that journalism is very much like that. But I feel, I think that I would be this way about fiction anyway, because I feel like, you know, I'm driven by this desire to explore a certain set of ideas or questions and environments. Those are the two things that kind of drive me. Some more abstract questions and then kind of physical time and place that I want to be part of. That's probably the strongest driving force. But then by the end, I find myself feeling like my, you know, my imagination and my curiosity have moved in other directions. So I do feel like for the moment, I just want to move away. Yeah. And it can be hard. Like, it can be hard to leave behind the voice of the last book. That's often a big challenge. Although this one with 13 different voices, I had, you know, that was a challenge I had all the way through. And I think that's one reason I listened to so much music, because it really helped me kind of leave behind one mood and move on to the next, because one of my goals was that each chapter really have a totally different mood and tone and feel from all of the others. That was actually really, I mean, that was the central technical challenge of the book.
And that was, why did you want to do that?
Because once I sort of realized that it was one book, but that it was happening in pieces, I felt like if I'm going to do a book in pieces that's actually one story, why not make the pieces as different from each other as they can possibly be? It just seemed like a kind of, it seemed like that I would be pushing what I was doing to its absolute limits. And I think, and I mean, I don't make these decisions in a very intellectual way, so I can't say that I sat here thinking, how can I push myself to my absolute limit? But I guess it just, I think of it more in terms of what seems exciting or fun. Mm-hmm. And it seemed exciting and fun to try to incorporate 13, or I didn't know how many there would be, but a number of pieces that felt completely unlike each other, that gave the reader a completely different experience each time in terms of the world that the reader would be part of, and yet also fused into one story. That just seemed really cool. I mean, later I thought, oh, I know what this is. It's a concept album. but I didn't know.
Like Sgt. Pepper's?
Or Quadrophenia. Yeah. I mean, Tommy, yeah. Ziggy Stardust. I mean, albums that really tell actual stories, more or less narratively, but certainly in terms of kind of a theme, but are built of pieces that are totally different from each other, and that's the fun of it. I mean, who wants an album in which all the songs sound the same? You know, it's the fun of it is going from something really fast to something slow. I love the thought of doing that in writing, although I have to say that I was already doing it before I kind of grabbed onto the concept album as something to help me explain what I was doing, but wasn't, I can't say that I was sort of inspired by that originally. I kind of wish I had been. But I did think of it as a record album fairly early. I knew there would be an A side and a B side. And again, you know, one of the things that I do find myself thinking about a lot with the music industry is just the, you know, and it's certainly been written about too, just the different way we buy music and what that means for musicians, not just in the obvious way that they're going broke and have to tour constantly, no matter how old they are, to make any money. I am getting a little begging here. But because they can't come up with one total vision, namely an album, or what we think of it as an album, a CD, and really expect the majority of buyers to engage in that total vision with them. You know, they're going to, basically people are going to buy the hits, or even if they don't know which ones the hits are, they're going to look at the bars that show popularity and think, oh, well, those must be the best or be most likely to listen to those. And I even do that. Whereas, you know, as anyone who has listened to albums or CDs knows, your favorites often end up becoming the ones that you had never heard of and never heard on the radio. So I found myself thinking about that, I guess, through Benny at first, but ultimately just as myself, thinking, wow, the equivalent for, in writing would be you write a novel and people only buy a few chapters. Like, how frustrating. So I love the idea of it being a little bit of an homage to a form that is becoming very fractured.
Yeah. Well, the other thing with those old albums would be like you would think that you didn't like this song, but you'd have to listen through it to get to the next one. And then over time, you would suddenly realize, oh, yeah, this one might actually be the best one on the whole album.
Exactly.
But it's only because you were kind of compelled from going to like one hit to the next to go through it. You could, its greater virtues would come out. Well, you know, I was thinking before I came, you know, what is a consistent theme in all of of Jennifer's books, and could there be one? And I did come to think, since we're at the New York Public Library, that one of the constant themes is sort of the idea of New York in a way, and the idea that there's this kind of realm of the winners, that, you know, that your characters always have a fraught relationship towards. Charlotte in Look at Me used to be part of the really cool club scene, the model, and now these people don't recognize her after she has this accident. And Danny and in The Keep used to be this kind of, I don't even know what profession he could be said to have. You know, he's a promoter.
Yeah, he's sort of a...
whatever that is.
Yeah.
He's just a guy that is somehow always at restaurants. And then, you know, when you have a sort of amorphous career like that, it could just kind of falls apart, and he sort of loses it. And a lot of the characters in Goon Squad are sort of, you know, Dolly, you know, she used to be the ultimate publicist, and then she has this she has this party that's supposed to be the party of the year, and then it turns out to be, you know, this debacle, and that causes all these people to be burned by hot oil. So great.
Not career enhancing. No. It's true.
No. So that there is, you know, there is this kind of sense throughout that there people are kind of striving to be in this, you know, this crowd that maybe they were in it for a while and they slid back and they, you know, could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think that's fair. I don't know if I would limit it to New York, because I think it actually does hold true even for my first novel, which has nothing, I guess I'd been to New York briefly when I wrote it, but I think I would broaden it to say that I think I've been fascinated for a long time by this question of people believing that their own lives are not real and other lives are more real, and kind of what drives that. And I feel like I've come at that from a lot of different angles. And it's funny, because I even talked about this exact question in writing about the teens, the closeted gay teens, this question of sort of what is real and what is not. And so, you know, in my first novel, it's about a girl whose older sister has committed suicide at the end of the 60s, and they looked very similar. And the younger sister has totally idealized the older sister's life and feels that somehow her life was, you know, very real and intense, and her own life is this kind of bland simulacrum. So she ends up taking her sister's itinerary, the postcards that she sent back from this trip she was on when she died, and following her, expecting something, which I think in that book, what I was ultimately interested in was the question of, you know, is that feeling that everything, that other things are more real than one's own life, basically just the longing for transcendence? Is it just the basic, you know, religious impulse? Or is it something else? And actually, another thing that I've been very interested, I think this actually feeds into the whole technology thing very much, because in that first novel, The Invisible Circus, I was really interested in that moment when mass media really permeated American life, you know, the televising of the Vietnam War, and also really the experience of the counterculture, both from those the point of view of those outside it and those within. And I have to credit Todd Gitlin, who's written really interesting work about this, both about his experience at SDS and then later about just his book about the 60s is just fantastic. But basically he posits that people didn't really know how to decode media imagery at that time in the way that we do now. So the counterculture was actually very small, but appeared to be vast. And so that both those within it and those outside of it perceived it to be this gigantic sort of galvanic force that it never really was. And he talks really interestingly in his book about the SDS about how that experience in a certain way poisoned the experience of SDS, because their sense of their own kind of stardom and enormity was actually very divisive and destructive. So anyway, all of those ideas were in my mind, and I think have been ever since. Yeah. And it's a combination of, yes, this question of what is real and what is not, and why there is this sort of human tendency, which I certainly felt you know, a lot as a younger person, less now. I think it's something I've kind of learned over time that actually, you know, my life is also real. You know, by 48, you would begin to figure that out. But I think it actually even comes from a kind of biographical place, in the sense that that was something I really felt as a teenager. Like, I am actually not real and other people are. Why? I don't know.
Pursuing a sort of situation or state or an environment where you could suddenly be real?
Well, kind of wanting to get near people who were real, which I think is a lot of what the kind of urge toward coolness or whatever it is, Charlotte calls it the mirrored room. I think that's so much what that is, a sense that certain lives are hyper-real and, you know, one's own is not.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but I guess, I mean, in a way, that's a banal topic, but I think it's sort of interesting in its various permutations and ramifications, and particularly the way in which technology and the media interact with it. Yeah. So, yes, I would say that is a universal through line.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'll ever be able to leave all of that behind. Yeah. I think that may be like a structural thing in me. But I keep changing everything else so that only certain astute readers will actually pick up on the total similarities.
Well, it's definitely true that at a certain point after... I don't know. Is that either one of us? Okay. After striving after all of these more and more perfect, you know, versions of the, you know, musical experience or transmitting or whatever, you kind of get to the point that the characters are in the chronologically later parts of Goon Squad. And now, of course, they're looking back at what they had before as being more real and more authentic, their past or, you know, the... before this, and Jen and I had figured out that we had been in some of the same punk rock clubs in San Francisco that she writes about. At the same time, we had been in the same room, which seems like such a Goon Squad twist that these two people, in a completely different context, talking to each other, had actually maybe been standing right next to each other in some skeevy nightclub.
Yeah, it's totally
on Broadway in San Francisco.
If there's anything we can do to stop this, please tell us. Yes, no,
we
it's
just being totally immobile.
Yeah, no, I think it's pretty likely that we actually physically occupied the same,
bumped into each other.
Yeah,
exactly. Definitely didn't say excuse me because I wasn't
that was really uncool.
but. You know, I often look back on that time and I think, well, that was the subculture that had nothing to sort of accelerate its formation. Like, there was no internet, and so everyone was sort of communicating by meeting face-to-face or, you know, these flyers that they would put up on telephone poles and kiosks and stuff like
that.
And the general idea was that it was a terrible problem. So, like, the mainstream media was against it, you know? Like, there were all these stories about it as a problem, the way that, like, drug use would be a problem. So it felt like it was, like, the last subculture that was actually a subculture. Like, nobody jumped on it and tried to capitalize it and make money off of it for many years.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, again, I was in high school, so I don't even know how aware I was of the media's attitude toward, you know, punk rock life. And I was also, you know, I was not really an insider at all in that world. That was yet another world that seemed very real, that I kind of felt, you know, I had a desire to be near it, but no way to really get into it. And I think in some sense also maybe didn't want to. Because in fact it was, at least what I saw of it, which was via a friend that I had gone to school with who became very immersed, it really was very dangerous. I mean, there
was scary,
needle sharing. I mean, I saw that repeatedly. And this was, you know, 1980, so 1 year before AIDS was named. Not what you wanted to be doing. So I'm pretty glad in retrospect that I couldn't get that close to the action. But you're right. I mean, there was, unlike the 60s counterculture, which I think at a certain point the media embraced with a kind of excitement, it didn't, I guess maybe that wasn't true for punk rock
culture. Well, it was trying so deliberately to be offensive that, you know, the whole point was to be rejected. And so, yeah, it just, it couldn't, but it was, you know, this kind of last gasp of sort of, you know, this renegade sort of thing. And so then all the characters, you know, you feel like the characters in, like Benny in particular and Scotty are sort of looking back on this time as their most authentic moment, although the actual depiction of it is kind of horrifying in the book.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, nostalgia, that impulse plays into this dynamic that we're talking about very strongly. I mean, imagining the past as having been sort of more intense and more real in a way is yet another kind of manifestation of that sense of a reality that you can't ever touch, that's never where you are, that seems to be more a product of the imagination or fantasy or some kind of mental process than you know, reality coming at you in the moment. That was something I was really interested in also in The Invisible Circus, where this girl's experience of her sister is so steeped in nostalgia all the time. That's part of what causes her to kind of elevate her in the way that she does. But your point about, the way in which part of what makes that seem authentic looking back is the fact that in a certain way, I think, 60s counterculture ultimately courted the media because it had strong messages that it wanted to impart and things that it wanted to happen and not happen. Punk rock, I mean, it was just like, let's just destroy everything or let's just get really drunk and have fun. There was no reason for them to court the media. They had nothing much that they wanted to, broadcast. But I keep wondering, I mean, I see kids now with mohawks, looking rather the same as kids did at the Mabuhay Gardens all those years ago. And it is striking that obviously still signifies something, many, many, many years later. Yeah. It's odd to me.
Who knows what it does signify to the people who are doing it. And you can't, I look back on it as this sort of, however scruffy or sometimes scary, as this authentic experience, but that could just be nostalgia that's making me think that, that was the last subculture or whatever.
Right, or maybe it's just that you're, nostalgic for those early years at college. I mean, it's so hard to know. Yeah. I would always notice when I first came to New York that people would often say that, the best years of New York have passed. And, wouldn't you know, those best years seem to always coincide with when they were new to New York. So it's funny. It's so hard to know. I mean, obviously, we tend to kind of universalize our own experience. It's just the way we're built. So it's who knows?
Yeah. And the time that you live transforms your ability to understand what's going on around you, that you're young and everything's fresh and new and seems so great. And then you get older and you're more disillusioned and you can't really tell if things have gotten worse or if it's just the change in your perspective, which is the Goon Squad effect.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, when I think back on those years in the 70s in San Francisco, in a way, one thing that made it so much fun to write about it was that I don't really remember them fondly, actually. it's funny. I think we were at such different, you were newly independent, kind of striking out in the world and able to somewhat do what you wanted for the first time, whereas I was sort of living at home and kind of an unhappy teen. And so while I wanted to get near all of this, because I think I just felt that there was something striking about it, especially, having lived in San Francisco since 1969, basically, as a kid, and even like I guess what you would now call a tween, really long feeling very sad about having missed the 60s. I mean, it was a crazy time to grow up there to not have really participated in that. And not only was I too young, but my parents had nothing to do with it. I mean, I wasn't even the child of hippies. I was just sort of, I just saw them out the window of the car occasionally as we drove by. So that I felt huge nostalgia and just incredible frustration about having missed that. And so then it was really amazing to collide with this world that just totally repudiated everything that all of that stood for. And I didn't repudiate it myself. The characters in the book do, but I didn't feel that way at all. I worked on Haight Street at a cafe my junior and senior years of high school. I wanted to be there, even if it was, it wasn't the same. I still wanted to be there physically. So, but it was, San Francisco was strange in that way. It was shaking off a hangover from the 60s, and then all of a sudden, this totally different, very snotty attitude came along, and it was kind of amazing.
Well, maybe we should just stop our little reminiscence here. I want to ask you before we go to questions about your famous PowerPoint chapter, because I know everyone's always curious about that. And again, I think one of the things that's fascinating about this is that you didn't have that much knowledge of PowerPoint before you decided to write a chapter in it.
I had never used it.
So how did that happen?
Well, as with all of the other answers, there are kind of little different seeds or, you know, whatever metaphor you want to use, various things connected. One thing was, okay, I had this mandate that every chapter was going to feel totally different from all of the others, which became harder and harder to accommodate as I did more things and then could not do them again.
Yeah.
So, for example, one thing I tried that didn't work, and I will always be sad about this, was epic poetry. I thought, God, wouldn't that be so great? And I was reading Don Juan, which is the most fantastic adventure story ever. And I thought, this seems easy. He's having a great time. Don Juan goes and does all these fantastic adventures. I'm just going to sit down and, like, let it rip. But, you know, obviously, you know, you actually have to be a poet to do that, turns out. Didn't work. So I was also interested in PowerPoint. I think the moment that I remember thinking I really want to try writing fiction in PowerPoint was reading an article in the Times about the election in 2008 and the turnaround of the Obama campaign. There was that moment where suddenly he started to get traction, his numbers went up, and then there were various analyses of why that had occurred. And there was a piece in the Times that alluded more than once to a PowerPoint presentation within the campaign that it had this really important effect. And I kept thinking, wow, they're actually calling it a PowerPoint. That's what I was stuck on.
That it had become a noun?
Well, in the old days, you would have read memo or paper or even presentation, but PowerPoint?
Yeah.
I mean, it was branded. I thought that was really striking. And I thought, okay, so this has really become a genre, a storytelling genre. And so I thought, well, if it's a storytelling genre, I wonder how it could work for fiction. Yeah. I had never used it. I didn't own it. I thought I might have it in my computer, but it wasn't there. As I discovered when I asked friends to send me their PowerPoints and I couldn't open them. And then I learned that it was actually rather expensive.
Yeah.
And worst of all, that I didn't have enough memory to actually hold it on my laptop. So I thought, that's fine. I write fiction by hand, so I don't really need that. So I sat down with my legal pad and drew a rectangle.
How did that work?
It was a disaster. I was back to prose, you know, by the next page. So so that stymied me, and at the beginning I thought, okay, I'm just not going to pursue this. But I did find myself unable to quite shake the idea, so ultimately I did spring for the memory and the program, and I could finally read PowerPoints. And then as I read them, I felt a kind of excitement that seemed hard to reconcile with their content, which, as you can imagine, was pretty dull. But I was excited by the charts. All of it was thrilling to me, and I thought, I think I'm not done with this. So then I thought, my initial thought of how I would use PowerPoint, you know, the question is, why is something in PowerPoint? You know,
well, you say that their content is dull, but then you just think how dull they would be if they weren't even in PowerPoint.
Well, they need to be in PowerPoint because they're making these.
Otherwise, they'd be so dull they'd just kill you.
Well, and the greatest sin, as I learned from my sister who works at Bain, is to create word walls. You do not want those. That's PowerPoint that doesn't use enough graphics. That's when it's just a lot of bullet points and words. She would say, "Oh, so boring. We were all falling asleep." So anyway, but there is this corporate feel to PowerPoint that's kind of unappealing from a fiction standpoint. So at first I thought, okay, so it's a corporate person that's telling the story. And I picked a minor character whose corporate future I would explore. But it didn't go anywhere because it was actually kind of dull. I mean, in a way, corporate, in the way I'm using the word, is kind of synonymous with dull. That's sort of what we mean when we say that, in a way. So anyway, after I'd sold the book, no one was expecting this PowerPoint, I suddenly had an idea of what I could do. And what I liked about the idea was that it not only solved the problem of not having a PowerPoint, which was driving me crazy, but it also solved another problem that had really been bothering me, which is that Sasha, the wallet thief from the first chapter, is, you know, one of the major characters in the book, and we explore her life at various moments. We learn that she marries and has children and lives in the desert, but we never see her there. And the reason we hadn't seen her there was that I couldn't figure out how to look at her there without writing about her again, which was something I had decided I wouldn't do, and without having it feel repetitive. But all of a sudden it came to me, what about her kids? What if one of her kids is the PowerPoint narrator? And that was, I have to say, that was a really good solution, because first of all, it solved my problem of not seeing Sasha's future, but also it totally neutralized the corporate element. And what I didn't realize until I got somewhat versatile with PowerPoint, which I'm sort of amazed to report that I really did ultimately, that I was able to write a kind of sentimental family story that I just don't think I would really do in conventional prose. I think it would have been soppy and actually not moving. But somehow the coldness of PowerPoint and the lack of connective tissue, the fact that you're stuck with these isolated moments, made it possible to tell this actually very kind of sweet, sentimental story.
It kind of had a little of the Little House on the Prairie kind of,
you know, imagine, and straight prose. It would have been deadly.
Yeah.
But somehow they balanced each other, I hope. Yeah. Not everyone loves that chapter, but it seemed to work for me. So it was, I would say that it was kind of an obsession. I mean, then once I started it, I had very little time to do it. And I would have to say I was possessed. I mean, I was doing PowerPoint when my husband went to bed. I was doing PowerPoint when he woke up. I mean, everyone was so tired of it. They would go to the beach. I would pull down the shades and do PowerPoint. And I couldn't. But then it was finally revealed to me why I had wanted to do PowerPoint all that time, which was that it really is the chapter where the whole strategy of the book kind of reveals itself. I mean, it's a book that consists of moments with big gaps in between. It's very much about time. And this chapter, which is called Great Rock and Roll Pauses, is composed of moments, which is what PowerPoint is, with pauses in between. And it's actually about the nature of pauses and their relationship to time. I mean, it just worked so well for what I was trying to do, and I felt like it was the reason I was yearning toward it without even having used it was that I think I sensed it would be the moment in which the kind of the heart of the book could be shown, and there was no other way to do it. So I was so grateful that it worked out, you know, that I was able to actually in time, you know, get the program and have an idea of how to use it and make it work. And it's almost embarrassing how much time I spent colorizing my PowerPoint. You're like a mad scientist with little tinctures of color for my website. I mean, here I, who'm using a Samsung, okay, I'm like creating a slideshow that was so technologically difficult to accommodate in SlideShare that they were never able to get the bugs out. But you can watch it as a continuous slideshow with music. You can hear the little pieces of
on
music.
On your website.
Yeah,
so
with the pauses in there.
Look that up if they haven't
And that
seen
was
it.
So exciting. Yeah. It was exciting to be able to do that.
And it was exciting to read. I think now would be a great time to go to the audience for questions. Do we have any questions out here? Right here in the aisle. I can't see too well, but...
Yeah, or you just yell it out and we'll repeat it.
Okay. Hi.
Sorry about that.
Hi, so basically, I was just wondering, I don't actually think it's on either. Okay, well, in any case.
Oh, there you go. There.
I was just curious to know if you had any characters that ultimately you had to kill in this story, or leave out, I guess, and if so, your thinking on that, was hard, and how you were able to navigate who you kept in and who you kept out, given that it was such a large world you created.
There were characters they were not characters that weren't in there already, but they were minor characters that I wanted to explore in a radical way, and I wasn't able to pull it off. some of them were, I mean, this is kind of dull for those who haven't read it, but that Rolf, who's a kid that we meet in one chapter, I really wanted to see him as an adult. Could not make it work. Susan, the ex-wife of Sasha's uncle, again, dull for those who haven't read it, sorry. She seemed intriguing to me. She was the one I thought might have a corporate future and write in PowerPoint, but I kept lapsing into prose. And usually the reason that these things, I had these three rules, I can't remember if I mentioned, that each chapter had to be about a different person. Each chapter had to have a completely different mood and feel, and each chapter had to stand completely on its own. And usually, I couldn't, not only could I not adhere to all of those rules in the failed chapters, I actually couldn't adhere to any of them. It seemed like if either it all worked or nothing worked. But usually the problem amounted to, it just wasn't good enough. It wasn't fresh enough. It didn't hold its own in this mix. And, you know, the thing is that telling stories in all these really different ways was not a matter of thinking, okay, here's the story I want to tell. What wacky format can I find to sort of impose on this and make it different so it'll work in this mix of things? If that would have been a lot much easier to do than what, but I don't think it actually would have worked. I had to find a story that demanded to be told in a strange way. The only way it would work.
Which one was the epic verse one? Did that?
I think I tried Rolf in epic verse, actually. I think maybe because of Don Juan being a young man, I thought that would be the right way. I have to confess that I really didn't get far with that. I can't say that was a whole chapter that had to go. It was more like I sat there and nothing was happening, and I sort of tried a little and realized that I couldn't create any material if I was trying to write poetry. But anyway, so that was what was difficult. Just being interested in a character was not nearly enough. I had to find a story about that character that required telling in a way that would not overlap with any of the other ways I had used, which meant, as I went on, that it had to get less and less conventional. And so that was a really tall order. I'm sort of amazed that I even managed it 13 times. So there were people that had to go. Unfortunately.
So then just as a quick follow-up, is that common for you to use a framework like that? Because it sounds like early on you were saying it sounds like you write blind, sort of just let yourself go, and yet this book had a really intentional structure. And then I won't ask anymore.
No, that's okay. usually if I'm writing a more central book, I don't have those kinds of requirements, no. I mean, in the act of writing, it always was that spontaneous thing. It's just that it got harder and harder to find an arena where I could even release that and let it happen, because I would feel immediately that I was kind of pushing up against other things, or that it was sounding too much like something else. So there was a kind of conceptual aspect to this that was different, but it didn't really affect the writing itself. And at first I barely felt it. It was only the image of painting myself into a corner occurred to me many times, because I would feel like I have nowhere to go. You know, I can't write about it. You know, then the danger too was if I introduced wholly new characters, well, then what about peripheral characters in their lives? I mean, this could go on forever, you know? So it was, it felt like the moves, I became more constrained as I went on. And yet the way I write, as you just pointed out, relies on a kind of freewheeling release that cannot happen if I feel totally constrained. That's why the epic poetry didn't work. So it became difficult as time went on. It did.
Okay. Over here.
So forgive me if I sound stupid, because I might be stepping on a minefield. But
that sounds interesting.
Well, I'm struck with what you say about the way the stories are connected, with some kind of similarities with some intensely plotted things that David Mitchell does. And they're like interconnected stories, and they go all over and do different things. And I just wondered if you could talk about the way, you know, your approach and that approach, and really kind of being sort of contemporaneous, if this is something that's maybe even a literary style that we're moving towards, sort of hyper-textual story linkage.
Well, unfortunately, this is going to be a short conversation, because I am ashamed to admit I have never read him. I don't, he's been on my list forever. I have Cloud Atlas. I have the new one, but I have actually not read his work. I've been told that we have things in common, and I'm really curious to read him. But I've heard your question about sort of are we moving this way, you know, toward you know, more fractured narratives, or you know, that kind of hypertext feeling of one thing yielding to another. And it certainly, I can imagine you could make a strong argument that we are, for all kinds of technological reasons. Like, I mean, I have two kids, and I'm terrified that, you know, they're not going to want to read books; they're just going to want to be online. You know, and they're going to get used to that kind of motion. You know, one thing just kind of dropping into another, and be unable to read the kinds of things that I really like to read, which are not like that. I can say for myself that I have no interest in doing this again anytime soon, because for me it always feels like a one-shot deal for me, because I now have told, you know, what I said about the small stories and how, or the individual parts, how they demanded this particular kind of telling, that was also true of the larger thing I was trying to do in this book. It was a kind of book that I couldn't have written any other way. You know, my models were things like The Sopranos. Like, I was really interested in how a work of fiction could emulate the kind of polyphonic quality of a TV series, for example. My other huge inspiration was Proust, gigantically sprawling book, unimaginable to do that nowadays, really. So I wanted to get the sense of that sprawl without the actual sprawl. So there were really specific reasons that I did this for this book, but having done it, I feel kind of tired of it personally. Just for myself, I want to try something really different next time. But it will be interesting to see if you know, in the larger culture, it's becoming more predominant.
And there's a little bit of an element, and I say this, we're about the same age as is others, is kind of a group of people coming along now who are kind of going that direction or breaking certain conventions or unities or things like that. But it also mimics kind of that wandering aspect of the internet itself. So.
Yeah, that's a funny analogy that I had not thought of when I was working on this. That it in some, I mean, as I said, my models were not that, and I wasn't actually on Facebook. It's funny because a number of people have said, "Oh, this is really a novel for the Facebook generation," and I think, well, okay, but that's an accident. But it may be that something about the quality of online experience was in my mind as I was working on this without my knowing it. I mean, the unconscious is very, very powerful. The one thing I would say, it's funny, I emotionally, what I find myself thinking when you say that more and more people are trying to do this is, oh, gosh, I don't know about that. But I think that's just the fogey in me worrying that, you know, I guess the big question for me always is, let's make sure, does the story require that? Or is it just a way of trying to use a gimmick? That's always the question. Now, some people, I think, would say this uses gimmicks, and you absolutely are guilty of that. But and it may be that it reads that way to some people, but I can say honestly that the way it happened, I was always led by the story and the characters, and that to the degree that I've, you know, experimented in my fiction, it's always because there was no other way. I felt like it was the characters in the story that led me to that, and I would be very wary of coming at it the other way, because I think the danger is that it just becomes kind of arty and dull. So that would be the danger. But, you know, every choice has its risks and its rewards, and it's, you know, it's always worth trying it and seeing how it comes out.
Okay, do we have any more questions out there? Okay. Yes.
I was just wondering if, since you spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, the different intersections of, you know, music and commerce and all that stuff, or whatever topic you're looking at, if you have anything to say about your, as a writer who is trying to sell books or is selling books very well, I guess, do you ever find yourself either sort of self-consciously worrying about that, or maybe not so much now, and do you have any commentary on the current sort of book industry with its interest in memoir versus fiction or anything like that? I know that's a big question.
Wait, no, I'm not totally sure what your question is. What the selling part, do you mean, how do I feel about kind of having to get out there and sell?
I guess there's two things. Yeah, like there's the, with book tours or whatever like that, but I'm actually thinking of your anxiety of selling. Like when you're sitting down to write, do you think, oh my gosh, will this be popular? Will this sell? Or do you feel like you're sort of, at this point, you're immune to it, but does it, how do you fight that?
Okay, and then your question about the memoir stuff is, do I think, oh, but nonfiction sells better and stuff like that? That's a great question. I do not. I do not think about those things. I think one reason I don't is that I don't think much, period, as I'm actually writing, which I love. And it's not that those thoughts don't occur to me, but they don't occur to me at times when they would actually impact my writing, because the writing itself is such an unconscious, almost meditative, although I don't meditate, so I don't know if that's really true, but a kind of a state of mind that feels sort of disconnected from my real life and my real concerns. I mean, that's why I gave that silly bio, but really I do write to escape. I have a great life, but... You know, so, for example, I would be the last person who would say, gee, memoirs are really popular, maybe I should write about myself. Because it occurs to me every single time I try to write about myself, and I do it occasionally in little ways, that if writing were only writing about myself, like if that's what writing were, I would not write. I would have a different career. I think I would be a doctor, maybe. Or an archaeologist, but I wouldn't do it. It's just not fun for me. The payoff for me is not there, because I don't feel lifted out of my life. I feel, you know, mired in it and forced to examine it closely in ways that don't seem interesting from a writing standpoint. So I guess in that way I'm kind of lucky, because it's not that it always goes well by any means, but if I'm actually writing, it means that I've gotten preoccupied with something that is really unconnected to my life and my world. And I honestly think that the fact that I do it by hand means that I'm also not connected to a machine that would tempt me to investigate things that are extremely unhelpful, like, gee, who's doing better? I mean, what an unhelpful question. And actually, because I'm not really attached to a computer all the time, I have other little rules that I try to follow, one of which is I have never looked at the Amazon page for Goon Squad, not once. I don't want to know my ranking. I don't want to know that, you know, some person somewhere hates it. I mean, why? Why would I want to know that? It doesn't help me to know it. It actually stymies me. So I try to really steer clear of that. I think one of the biggest challenges for a writer is to try to, navigate away from unhelpful distractions. There are plenty of distractions you can't avoid, and they have to be contended with. But there's a way in which I think, especially online, we are tempted to go looking for unhelpful and depressing distractions. Why? It's hard to avoid, but having a rule makes it easier. Because now, I mean, I guess it's the way someone who gives up smoking feels. I feel like if I go on Amazon now, I mean, I've done it for other books, and it is like an addiction. It's like, I have to know. Oh, no, it's terrible news. Oh, my God, why? You know, I try not to go there.
Okay, I think we are...
One more question.
We have one more?
So hi, I'd love to hear about your beginnings, like how the wish to write grew in you when you knew you had it. You also are a journalist and did the fiction and the journalism Never Duke It Out, and also how you cultivated, I mean, it's great to hear your vision as an author, and was there anything that you did other than writing and reading that helped you to cultivate your vision? Because it seems like a lot of people don't sit down to write something different than they've ever written before. Like, is there anything in the way that you grew as a writer that, you know, was any specific kind of books you read or any kind of sort of path that you put yourself on to cultivate that bravery and vision as an author?
Okay, let me think. So that's, I'm going to answer the first one first and then the last one and then the middle one. I did not grow up wanting to be a writer. I really did think I wanted to be a doctor for a long time and then an archaeologist. And I took a year off between high school and college, and I got a backpack and traveled in Europe. And in fact, the itinerary of my protagonist in The Invisible Circus is in fact my own itinerary, because at 18, I saved every little postcard and map, and I had this and took all these notes. I had a fantastic record of my trip. But I also had a really hard time. I mean, I was 18 alone. You know, again, I don't know if anyone would have quite this experience now because everyone's online. But then you had to wait in a long line just to get on the phone and maybe reach your parents if they were home. So I felt very disconnected and quite unmoored, and actually started having panic attacks, which I thought, back to San Francisco in the 70s, were drug flashbacks. So I thought I was in the middle of Go Ask Alice, and it was just, you know, a few short stops before I was locked up, you know, looking out a window and remembering all these adventures I was having. I really did think that way. So in the course of that very difficult trip, which I ended up kind of having to come home from on a slightly emergency basis, I decided I was going to be a writer. I can't quite tell you when it happened, because I was in such a state of disarray and sort of being freaked out. I don't know, but I think I was just in such extremis that it was revealed to me in some sense that this was not only the thing that anchored me, but actually what gave the world meaning for me. It was like it had been there all along, but I hadn't seen it. I'd been writing the whole time, but I didn't think I would actually want to be a writer. I had no confidence ever that I would be successful, and I still tend to think in terms of, you know, well, that was good, but I'll never do it again. That's kind of my mindset. You know, I don't head into a project thinking, ho, people are going to love this. it's not the way I am. I tend to expect the worst, but I love doing it so much, and it's so much a part of just my relationship to the world that I do it happily anyway. So, you know, obviously I really do love it. But I really never wavered from that point on. I was absolutely clear, even when I had no reason to expect, I mean, even when I was writing the worst stuff in the world, and, you know, even my own mother was reluctant to comment, and was difficult to reach briefly after she read my first novel. I was absolutely dogged in my commitment. Now to answer the third question about whether there's some sort of a vision and where that came from. My thought as you were asking that question was just to mention travel. I've traveled a lot on my own. To faraway, I went to China in 1986 with a backpack. I actually was with a friend, but she hated it and left. So I feel like those, you know, ultimately weeks and weeks really of time alone in circumstances that felt really far away, and very disconnected from my world, I think were really formative somehow. I can't quite say how. It's not that I ever wrote anything good while I was doing that. I did often try. In fact, the horrible novel that my mother became unreachable over was written largely while traveling and reading Proust. Terrible combination. Endless sentences, you know, on rattling trains. It was a disaster. But I feel like somehow that all that time that I've spent alone in alien circumstances, and by that I only mean not what I was used to, I think was very formative for me in some way. And I encourage people to, I think we, you know, I wonder, it's, you know, one is rarely alone anymore. That feeling of disconnection, I think, is almost ancient history, at least for people in the first world. For me, it was so critical that I feel lucky that I didn't come of age now, honestly. I just wonder whether I would be thinking or doing the things that I'm thinking and doing now if I had. But maybe I would have. Maybe this is just nostalgia. Hard to say. Yeah. As far as the journalism goes, that actually happened accidentally. I did love the idea of being a journalist as a kid, actually. That's probably the one kind of writer I thought I might be. I love the idea, because I was very nosy and still am, and I love the idea of being basically allowed to just pry into other people's lives as much as I wanted. And I especially like the idea of like being an undercover journalist. But in fact, the only reason that I am doing journalism now is that when I was trying to learn about the modeling world for my novel Look at Me, I would call modeling agencies and say, you know, I've published a novel. I'm really interested in learning about your business. And they would basically hang up on me. Or the other phone, I would go on hold and they would never come back. And it became clear to me that they were not, I was not actually going to get any access to this world presenting myself as I was. It didn't have any value to them. So right about then, a friend of mine became an editor of the Times Magazine, and he said, you know, we want someone to do a story about these young girls who are living basically as adults with very little education in New York, like 15, 16 years old. And I thought, I wonder if I called these places back and said I worked for the New York Times, whether they would actually listen to me. And so I took on the assignment, assuming it wouldn't work out. As I've told you, I kind of assumed that always, but I had every reason to assume that since I had never done anything like that before, just thinking, look, at the very least, I'll have access to this world. But it ended up working out, and so I continued to write for the Times Magazine, and really that was the origin of it. But as you pointed out, I mean, right from the beginning, there was a kind of connection between the fiction and the nonfiction. I was using it as a way to do research.
Okay. All right. I think we are...
Thank you so much.
At the end. Thank you. That was great.
Really nice.